to a great or lesser extent, that we are saturated in everydayness. I know that for most of his rabbinic career, my father didn't have any screens in his office, whereas I have a computer screen in the front office and one in the back office and a television screen, and they were all on this past week. And every minute's update was precious. And that didn't include the emails and the phone calls and the sense that nothing could happen at any moment without hearing about it moments later. And the problem with such a constant saturation in the events of the moment is that when reporters tell you that they're going to give you context for a story, that means they're going to tell you what happened last week. But last week isn't context. Last week is still journalism. 100 years ago is context. 50 years ago is context. And so I want to begin this morning by talking about something that happened 100 years ago. I know that 100 years is in some ways an arbitrary cutoff point. It's almost like when two kids are hitting each other, and each one tells you in successive waves about what the philosophers would call causality, which is another way of saying he hit me first. And you can go back and back and back, and since there is no beginning of history, there is no beginning of the story. But this past week, on July 12th, a very important 100th anniversary was observed. And you cannot understand what is happening in Israel without understanding that anniversary. It was the anniversary of the pardon of Alfred Dreyfus. 100 years ago, July 12th, 1906, the French government pardoned an innocent man. Now, there is already a question about how you pardon someone who didn't do anything wrong, but I want to remind you what the Dreyfus trial was about. Alfred Dreyfus was an arch patriot. He didn't have much of an identity as a Jew, but he had a very powerful identity as a Frenchman. And he was accused of passing secrets to the Germans and charged with treason. The trial electrified the world. And all over Western Europe, people sent their best reporters to France to cover the trial of this Jew who had betrayed the French government. The leading intellectuals of the time ranged themselves on two different sides to their everlasting credit or their everlasting shame, because it became clear pretty early on to anybody who looked at the evidence that Dreyfus was innocent. And in fact, it was later proved and admitted that the notes that incriminated him were forged and planted by other members of the military. Zola, the great French novelist, wrote a famous pamphlet called J'accuse, I accuse, in which he spoke openly about the anti-Semitism of French society and the French government. And he wasn't alone. In fact, some Eastern European Jews emigrated to France because of the Zola affair, because they figured had Zola happened in Poland, they would have just killed him and that would have been it. But at least in France, it was a cause célèbre. It was a huge trial. There was an argument. There was at least some purchase to be gained by those who believed in justice. Zola himself was not perhaps as large a personality as we would have hoped for such a large historical role. He never quite figured out why all of this was happening to him, although he did have the integrity, it seems, to refuse a pardon, although latest research suggests that maybe he really accepted it. It's a controversy, And one contemporary supporter, Charles Péguet, a French Catholic activist, said, "We were ready to die for Dreyfus. It's too bad Dreyfus wasn't ready to die for Dreyfus." I bring all this up because what the Dreyfus trial proved to many Jews was that it was impossible, no matter how assimilated, no matter how patriotic, no matter how loyal one was to the states of Western Europe, it was impossible to live there on the same terms as Christians. And Austria sent a young journalist who had already begun to make his name to cover the Dreyfus trial in 1894. His name was Theodor Herzl. And Herzl covered the trial, and 2 years later, having had his eyes opened by the Dreyfus trial, wrote Der Judenstaat, The Jewish State, in which he called for Jews to have a state of their own. I bring this up because it is not fair to say that nothing has changed in 100 years. But it is fair to say that too much has not changed in 100 years. If you listen to the reports and you read the press, not just today, but last week and last month and last year, if you listen to intellectuals on both sides of the Atlantic, some Jewish, alas, and non-Jewish, you discover that the idea that Jews should be sovereign over themselves is still an idea that sits uneasily with much of the world. 100 years later, they were going to build a memorial to Alfred Dreyfus, and his own descendants in France scotched the idea. They said, "Don't build the memorial. After all, it will just increase anti-Semitism." And so against this historical background, we come to today. Because what strikes me every time, and unfortunately this is not the first, there is a crisis, although this may well turn out to be the most severe for some 30 years. But every time there is a crisis, there is an asymmetry of fear. The fears are not equal on different sides. Syria does not fear for its continued existence as a country. Iran doesn't believe that tomorrow there will be no Iran. And yet, every crisis for Israel is an existential crisis. It doesn't matter how strong we are militarily. We are a sliver of a country. It doesn't matter how many reserves we can call up. We are a minuscule people. And even though if you put a very small lens on a small part of a small country, we may look very strong. Dreyfus's grandson died in Auschwitz. In other words, anti-Semitism to us is not only theoretical, it's not that long ago that we were almost completely destroyed. Now I know, and you do, that there is a regrettable tendency among Jewish leaders and Jewish writers and unfortunately among rabbis. Every single time something goes wrong in Israel, to say, "Remember the Holocaust." The Holocaust is not an excuse for anything and everything that Jews do. And not every crisis is a harbinger of destruction. But how far away is Iran from nuclear missiles? And how seriously must we as Jews take it when those who either have or will soon have nuclear weapons declare explicitly their desire for the destruction of the state? I remember the argument, foolish and fruitless though it was, about whether the Palestinian Authority had really repudiated in their charter the call for the destruction of the State of Israel. I cannot tell you how many hours of ridiculous sophistry I sat through where people parsed documents in Arabic that they couldn't even read to say whether or not the Palestinian Authority had really officially stopped calling for the destruction of the State of Israel. But let me assure you, even if they did, Hamas didn't. And you notice who they voted into power. Even if they did, Hezbollah didn't. And you know who is right over the border in Lebanon. I don't know, and I don't pretend to preach to you, many of whom know at least as much, and in some cases much more, about the political situation than I don't pretend to know the right strategy. But anybody who studies Jewish history becomes something of an expert on the right fear. And the right fear is that people who wish to destroy the state are not becoming weaker. They are becoming stronger. That radicalism, whatever the reason, is not flattening out across the Islamic world. Last night in this sanctuary, we had an extraordinary service, a service that takes place once a year. It is a Friday Night Live where we invite Fulbright scholars from all over the world through UC Santa Barbara to come and participate in the Friday Night Live service. And last night we had scholars from countries like Holland and China, but also from Yemen, from Jordan, from Lebanon, Islamic scholars from Pakistan, and they came and they sat and they clapped, and in some cases they sang, and it was a beautiful and meaningful thing. And then afterwards, I invited all of the scholars to come and join me in the chapel where I opened the Torah and I explained the Torah scroll and the Ark and the eternal light, and I asked them for questions, and they asked all sorts of questions about Judaism and Islam and Christianity. And then towards the end, the scholar from Pakistan said, "I don't have a question, but I have a comment." He said, "I must tell you, I have never been in a synagogue before. I've never been in a Jewish prayer service before, and I've never met a rabbi before, and I've never looked a rabbi face to face." He said, "And this is nothing like what I was taught. And nothing like what I expected. And the community, and the prayers, and the openness, and the beauty of the service completely took me by surprise and changed forever the way that I see Judaism." So I said to him, "When you return to Pakistan, please tell them." To which he said, "It won't make a difference." And that's what I remember. It's wonderful that he was here. But having gone through that, knowing where he grew up, his verdict was, it won't make a difference. "Get out of Gaza," they said. "Really, it's your presence there that is causing the unrest." And we got out, and guess what? Didn't make a difference. "It was terrible what you did in Lebanon. Leave Lebanon. Let Lebanon rule itself as it should." So we did. And it didn't make a difference. I don't know the answer. I'm not saying, therefore, we should go back into Lebanon. We should bomb Gaza. I don't know. But I am against illusions and all for fear. I think we have, thank God, a very strong state and very smart people who evaluate strategic options, and to this point, and God willing, forever into the future, a country that stands behind the state of Israel and understands not only its strategic value, but its spiritual value. And we are too wise a people, and we have been around too long to succumb to an easy paranoia and think at any moment we are poised on the brink, on the edge of destruction, but we are also too wise to think that destruction cannot happen, that catastrophe is impossible, that we can't go to bed feeling safe. Just this morning, Israel issued an ultimatum to Syria. You have 72 hours to return the soldier or we will attack. If, God forbid, that happens, I don't know. I don't know. And so I turn to the words of the Haftorah this morning. To the words of Jeremiah, who saw the great destruction, who saw Jerusalem when it was destroyed for what turned out to be the great catastrophe of our history, which we are about to commemorate on Tisha B'Av. Jeremiah, who knew what it was to have a state of Israel and to see it slip away. And this is what he said. Va'omar, aha Adoni, Adonai Elohim, hine lo yadati diber ki na'ar anochi. I replied, but Lord God, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to speak, for I am still a boy. Vayomer Adonai Eli, and God said to me, Al tomar na'ar anochi, don't say that you are a child. Ki al kol asher ashlachecha telech, wherever I send you, you will go. V'et kol asher atzavcha tedaber, and whatever I tell you to speak, whatever I command you, you will say. Al tirab mipnehem. Don't be afraid of them. Ki itcha ani. For I am with you. Lahatzilcha. I am with you to save you. Amar Adonai. These are perilous times, and they are likely to become more frightening before they become less frightening. But Jeremiah saw perilous times too. And he left God's words to us. Al tira mipnehem. You can be cautious, you can be fearful, but you should not be afraid. Ki itcha ani lahatzilcha. Because I, the Lord your God, am with you to save you. And in the end, we will survive. Shabbat shalom.